Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Just a reminder that this is a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking any calls. Kevin Powell is here. He is the Brooklyn activist and Democratic primary candidate against Adolphus Towns the last two elections. He plans to run again next year, by the way. Some of you may also know him from his role on the first season of MTV's The Real World back in the day. Kevin Powell is the author of 10 books now, including a brand new one called Open Letters to America. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. I wish I could open my eye right now.
You got a little contact lens problem, huh?
Yeah, but I'm glad to be here. It's weird that it happened today of all days with your interview and then the book release parties tonight. So I hope I can see the people tonight.
Well, I hope it straightens out by tonight. Kevin Powell is here with his eyes closed, usually prides himself on trying to have his eyes wide open. But it's radio, so you'll get through it. I see that you dedicate this book to Gloria Steinem and Susan Taylor. Taylor is the past editor of Essence.
Right.
Gloria Steinem is Gloria Steinem. Why those two women?
Well, you know, they've had a big impact on my life, Brian, over the last 20 years or so, just in terms of my evolution as a thinker and as an activist. I think they're really courageous women, the stands they've taken around gender issues, the fact that they've really been forthright in talking about healing, not just of communities of people, but also themselves, you know, everything from Susan Taylor's In the Spirit columns and essays to, you know, the Revolution Within book that Ms. Steinem did. And so they've been great models for me. And I've always said to folks that I feel the real leadership in our country oftentimes and around the world have been women. And I really feel that strongly that women like them should be acknowledged even more for the work they've done.
On Steinem, is it a little demographically unusual for a young black male activist from Brooklyn to dedicate a book to an older white feminist?
You know, I met her through Bell Hooks. You know, that was our connection. But, you know, honestly, no. You know, the hope is for our country that we can get to a place where we can begin to drop those kind of labels. And I see her as a human being and just my sister in the work that we do. And we've worked together a few times, and it's been tremendous. And I sometimes forget that she's now 75 years old. She's a serious, iconic figure who's been around for a long time, but she's as young as ever and just an amazing, amazing woman. I'm happy that she sees me as someone that she can work with.
And so this relates to your history, which we have talked about before because you wrote a whole book on it that you came in for. As an abuser at one time in your life, and your transformation around that to being an advocate for a new kind of maleness.
Absolutely. You know, between the years 1987 and 1991, I was one of those young men who had swallowed whole definitions of patriarchy, of sexism, of thinking that maleness had to do with competition and domination and controlling of women and girls and obviously, you know, how I related to males as well. And, you know, through counseling, years and years of counseling and being introduced to the writings of people like Gloria Steinem, Bell Hooks, Audre Lorde, and a number of incredible women, and recognizing that in my 4 years at Rutgers University, I barely read any works or thinkings, heard any speeches or anything by women writers, it really transformed me. And I never thought, Brian, that I would become someone on the other end all these years later, who just this year was on Oprah talking about the whole Chris Brown Rihanna situation, who just put together a big domestic violence prevention summit in Brooklyn. And honestly, every week I now get emails or letters from women and girls from around the country and overseas about being in abusive situations, and I find myself now on the other end actually counseling these situations. So it's really been an amazing journey for me, and I say to men all the time, even if you've never been an abuser, it's really important for us to empathize with the struggles of women and girls. And I really applaud the New York Times Magazine for putting together a cover story. About 2 months ago, you probably saw it, that said their civil rights and human rights issue of the 21st century is ending violence against women and girls. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Kevin Powell, my guest on WNYC, his new book, Open Letters to America. There are three of them, and one of them is An Open Letter to American Women, as he titled it. And we can take phone calls for Kevin Powell on that or other things, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You mentioned the Chris Brown Rihanna case.
Yes, sir.
And you say that the reaction from men to your appearance on Oprah about that was muted. You don't mean to suggest that most men want to be soft on that kind of domestic abuse, do you?
Well, what I mean is that, you know, 90% of the responses I got were from women and girls, and there were a few men who spoke out about it, different backgrounds. You know, it's not just any particular race or ethnic group, but it's striking. I think that, you know, unfortunately, as I write about in that essay, Open Letter to an American Woman, most men, we don't have to think about gender privilege. We don't have to think about every day waking up what it is to be a man. We don't have to think about walking down the streets of New York City and am I going to be harassed today? Is someone going to say something disrespectful to me? Am I going to be sexually harassed at work? You know, will I be passed over for a pay raise as a woman even if I'm doing the same work that a man is doing or even doing better work than that man? There's a whole range of issues that we don't think about. And one of the things I say to men and I said in response to males who, you know, felt, you know, well, what about what Rihanna did? You heard that kind of stuff a lot. I say, you know, one, even if you're not the kind of male who would ever call a woman out by her name, would ever put your hands on a woman, God forbid, doing any kind of destructive stuff that I describe in the book to women and girls, but you say nothing about it, you really become just as guilty a participant and a silent participant. And so what I'm getting at is that we have to understand as males that gender violence, gender discrimination is not going to end until we help to make it end. That's the reality.
And she's out now saying that after she went back with Chris Brown, after the very publicized abuse.
Right.
She didn't stay with him because then she started to acknowledge to herself the importance of her as a role model. There she was, 21 years old, going back into an abusive relationship and realizing, oh my God, women around the world, girls around the world,
right,
are looking at me.
That's right.
I have to walk away from this for them, which is a lot of presence of mind. For, you know, we like to probably on this station, you know, dismiss the whole Chris Brown, Rihanna thing as tabloid stuff. But that takes a lot of courage.
And it's actually symbolic of a larger problem in our society around violence. I mean, just driving here today, Brian, I mean, hearing the story of the 15-year-old girl who was shot in the head yesterday in the Bronx, I mean, you know, I just did a tour of rural Georgia in the last 2 weeks. And it was incredible because, you know, you hear the same stories. A lot of times we think these things are just germane to urban or city environments. It's pervasive around the country. And I think, you know, when we talk about change and hope 1 year after Barack Obama was elected, and this is pointed to point in the book, okay, now that he's president of the United States, what are we really going to do on a local level around the country to deal with these issues of gender violence, of male against male violence, of serious class issues around poverty, et cetera? I saw poverty in rural Georgia like I've not seen in places overseas, quite frankly, you know, and I think that we have some really, really, really serious work to do. And I think also, you know, I need to say this, I think the expectations for Mr. Obama are so wildly high. There seems to be this kind of great letdown and disappointment that I'm sensing as I travel around the country. And what I've been saying to folks as an activist is, you know, what do you plan on doing in your particular community locally to affect some sort of change? You know, it could be a soup kitchen. It could be issues of gentrification.
Remember when that was supposed to be sort of the Obama campaign too?
That's right.
You know, we had a clip. We had a caller on the morning after the election who said, well, this is great, but now I have to have two jobs, my own job and my second job for America, because that was supposed to be part of the president's inspiration. And it seems to me that a lot of that has fallen away, or at least has fallen out of the news.
Well, look how many people did not vote in the mayoral election, both the primary in September and then in November. You know, I was in Atlanta when our election happened in Atlanta. Only 70,000 people in a city, you know, metropolitan areas, you know, has millions of people voted in their mayoral election, forcing a runoff. And so it seems that we kind of treated the Obama campaign as like a reality show, if I can bring that analogy up for a second, Brian, where
and
we got really
know.
Titillated. We were very excited about it. Folks were, you know, seemed to be turning this corner from the kind of apathy that we saw for much of this decade. But almost after the inauguration ended, I started getting all these kind of calls and emails from people like, well, what do we do now? And that's why I wrote the first essay, Open Letter to Young America, really trying to address some of these issues. And I'm sure you talked about it, but The Nation magazine has a great piece called Obama Generation, about how there have been a lot of folks who've gotten involved in activism, have left their traditional jobs. New York Times wrote about it a couple of months ago, folks mm-hmm. who said, I'm not going to be a lawyer anymore. I want to work for a nonprofit. I want to work for a campaign again. But I think what we thought was going to happen, which is this kind of mass movement of people, simply is not happening. And it's really disappointing because we have so much work to do, as you know.
When you travel around the country and find disappointment in Barack Obama, what are people saying they're disappointed with?
Wow. It really, you know, say from young people in general, there's a sense that he's not progressive enough. That comes up a lot. You know, we thought he was going to be different. He was going to lead this kind of progressive movement. And it's interesting, Brian, because I think that people, you know, expected what happened with the Reagan Revolution in the 80s to happen here. But I think what I say to younger folks and older folks is that a progressive movement is only going to happen if progressive people actually stop talking about it and actually start doing something. During the Reagan-Bush era, as you know, it wasn't just Mr. Reagan. It was the fact that a lot of young people started saying, we're going to organize young Republican groups on college campuses around the country. It happened in my school, Rutgers University. We're not going to stop there. We're going to steer the spiritual and religious conversations of this country. My name is Ralph Reed. I'm a 20-something young man in the 1980s. I'm going to create the Christian Coalition. It didn't stop there. Media personalities like a Rush Limbaugh, you know, became megastars, as you know, because they began to dominate the airwaves. And so what I'm saying to folks on the left, progressive folks of all different backgrounds who really want to change this country, you cannot expect Barack to do this by himself. We've got to create local movements, pockets of progressive action around the country, and then we're connected to each other. I mean, think about it. The Reagan movement wasn't even an internet the way it is now, and so there's really no excuse for us. But it's, the question is, are we going to go past and look past our ideological differences, our racial differences, et cetera, and say, what do we have in common as a people who really want to bring our country forward in the 21st century? What am I willing to do to help change this country? And I say to folks, identify one or two things that you're very passionate about. It could be the environment. It could be HIV, AIDS. It could be just something, and actually do something about it. That's what has to happen. And let's begin to talk with each other across these little boxes that we put ourselves in around race and class and gender, which really are further ways of dividing us as progressive people, in my opinion.
Kevin Powell, author now of Open Letters to America, and Phil in Hunts Point. You're on WNYC. Hello, Phil. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how you doing? Love the show. I've been watching Mr. Powell since way back in his original MTV days, and I'm glad to say that my move towards being a male black feminist has paralleled his.
Wow.
My question is, looking at a larger patriarchal society, we know that male privilege exists, but as a black man, I don't know whether or not I personally, in terms of average education attainable, in terms of incarceration rates, even in terms of earning power, am enjoying that sort of level of male privilege. And even though we live in a patriarchal society, as black men, you aren't in the same position to do as much about it or to benefit as much from the ostensible patriarchy. So I wonder if Mr. Powell has any input on that.
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. I mean, I think we as black males or Latino males or white males who are anti-patriarchy, anti-sexism, have got to align ourselves with men of other backgrounds. For example, I have a lot of love for Michael Kimmel and Jackson Katz, folks like that who do some amazing work, who happen to be white brothers, Jewish brothers who do anti-gender violence work, anti-sexism work. And at the same time, I respect them because they do talk about the kind of racial privilege that white males have. And Brian, you talked about this privilege piece when we did a Dr. King program, I think 3 years ago.
That's right, at Brooklyn Museum.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think if we can create spaces like that where we can have honest conversations, because it's not an either or to me, you know, do we just deal with racism as black males, or do we also deal with gender violence? The reality is if racism disappeared tomorrow, we would still have a lot of violence in our communities of color, just as there's levels of violence in white communities as well. So I think, you know, my thing is like, you know, let's put ourselves in as many spaces as possible where we can have these kind of necessary dialogues, but also action that's going to lead to some sort of progress around this issue.
It was Phil, thanks so much for your call. Call us again. It's complex in the African-American male situation in that, yes, like in, you know, in other communities, men tend to do the bulk of the domestic physical violence.
Right.
But black men are so down, even compared to black women, in so many other ways. When you look at employment, you know, we know that with respect to college admissions,
absolutely,
college attendance now, the gap between black females and black males is really astronomical and, you know, very surprising to people who hadn't looked at it before. And so we get to a point like in this recession where, again, in general, for everybody, it's hitting men harder than women, and
absolutely,
so much so in the African-American community. I mean, what does that do to a sense of maleness?
Well, you feel disempowered, Brian. You feel that you're worthless. And, you know, we also know that in this recession, this great recession of the past year, domestic violence cases across the board have gone up in the last year or so. And so one of the things that I think is important for men of all different backgrounds, but I'll say specifically for black males for a second, is that we've really got to think long and hard about creating spaces where we talk about what manhood is, because I think so much of it is tied to this notion of you've got to be this breadwinner. One of the things I always say jokingly when I do get married, and I do plan on getting married one day, is I don't want to be the breadwinner. I want to be the co-breadwinner. I want to be the co-head of the household. It's a conscious decision to kind of change the paradigm of what a relationship looks like.
That means you got to be the co-stay-at-home if you have kids.
And I'm down. I am down. I have male friends who have done that. They spend 6 months at home and their wives spend 6 months at home. But I think, unfortunately, a lot of us are just kind of out there and we're not processing all these kind of complicated relationships. And so our natural reaction is just to react, you know, and lash out. It's interesting because even in the Chris Brown Rihanna situation, I'll say this, he was wrong, and he has admitted that he was wrong, obviously, but he's been demonized in a certain kind of way where it's almost like, there are folks in the black community who are saying, well, okay, when does this ever end, and is there going to be space for him to be redeemed? So we do have to have conversations about how racism operates when black males engage in certain kind of behavior that other males certainly engage in as well.
Let me take one more call for you, because I think Marco in Soho is calling with a plea for help in a current situation, and maybe you can help him out a little bit.
Okay.
Marco, you're on WNYC.
Thanks, Brian, for having me. Yeah, I had a question for Mr. Paul. My mother was actually victimized yesterday, assaulted by her partner of a couple of years, and actually relatively severely injured. And I caught myself having the first natural reaction of being, I'm going to kill this guy. Basically, just being really aggressive, and I pondered on it for a second, realizing, well, what does maleness mean in terms of a supportive role? Obviously, aggression is really the wrong thing, in particular for my mother. She doesn't want to experience her son being aggressive now also. So what can a male in a supportive role do to in a situation like this?
Well, I think, one, encourage the woman, your mother, your girlfriend, and whoever it is, your sister, your female friend, to get out of the relationship as soon as possible. I wrote an essay earlier in the year, which you can find on my website, kevinpowell.net, called Men Can Stop Domestic Violence. And one of the things I suggest is that we've got to encourage women not to have their self-esteem tied to that relationship with that male. That if that male is going to change, if he's going to be redeemed, he's got to be willing to do it on his own. You know, you cannot stay in that relationship. It could destroy you, and you literally can be killed by it.
Marco, you're talking about a serious injury to
Absolutely.
Your mother. Is she in a safe place now, separated from her abuser?
Yes, she is, and thank God the neighbors called the police when this happened. Now, unfortunately, it didn't happen in the United States, where he most likely would have been arrested and locked away right away. It happened in Germany, where she lives, and all the police did was take away his key to the apartment. So, I'm in contact with them, and I'm trying to make sure she's as safe as possible. But, in terms of, my personal reaction, I just felt, okay, my first feeling being rage and aggressiveness towards him, but then I realized, it's really my mom that needs me to be there and not be aggressive.
And I want to encourage you to go on the Amnesty International website as quickly as possible. There's a whole series of campaigns they've created globally around ending violence against women and girls, because I know there's safe spaces for her in Germany, and that's what you want to get her to as soon as possible. And then number two, there's got to be some sort of counseling involved. Is she willing to do that?
And Marco, is she willing to do that, counseling?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the first steps that I took to try to get her, the psychological help she needs, in particular because I can't be there for her.
Right.
Marco, thank you, and good luck.
You.
Anybody else with advice for Marco can post to this segment's page on our website. That's the Kevin Powell page. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and Marco, maybe you want to check back on our page later and see if anybody else gave you any advice. It sounds like he's handling it as best as he can
Absolutely.
From afar. And we have to leave it there with Kevin Powell, whose new book is Open Letters to America. Any place people can see you do a book signing or anything?
I definitely will be doing some Barnes & Noble signings in the next couple of months. So I would love – we'll post it on our kevinpowell.net website. And, Brian, thank you for having me and tolerating me with my eyes closed today.
Your voice and your brain are working. Thank
Appreciate
you for joining
it.
Us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And on this Christmas Day, we want to thank everyone who worked on this program this year. Our core producers, Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, and Paige Cowett. Our webmaster, Amy Pearl. And that's Debbie Fountain at the audio controls, except when it's Jason Isaac, Leora Noam Kravitz, or Mike Lupica. The program director is Chris Bannon, and the senior producer is Megan Ryan. We've had lots of interns and per diem producers who have contributed throughout the year. Here we go. Interns Tala Al-Husri, Neil Makija, Mary Beth Holman, Rachel Senator, David McCabe, Smriti Rao, Maureen Sullivan, Maggie Martin, Jordan Schneider, Michelle LeGros, Matt Gurry, Amanda Reisman, Julia Ferlin, Jared Merisman, and Justin Pastana. Per diem producers, Kate Hines, Eileen Markey, Shuba Bala, Kira Feldman, Alan Smith, Nadia Zonis, Michael Bernstein, Valerie Lipinski, and Annie Schreffler, our Uncommon Economics editor. Thanks to the guest hosts who filled in for me this year, Jamie Floyd, Mike Pesca, Mario Murillo, Amy Eddings, Beth Fertig, and Andrea Bernstein. Thanks to the entire Green Space team and special event helpers, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Mark Phillips, and Alex Goldmark. And a special shout-out to the former executive producer who left for England this year, Nuala McGovern. Thanks, everybody. Have a great holiday weekend. The Brian Lehrer Show will be back live on Monday.